Welcome to the wundersame Fahrradwelt, your cycling podcast about fixed gear, gravel and ultra cycling. Hosted and produced by the one and only Johanna Jahnke.
My guest today is Chaz Christensen, aka Not Chaz. Chaz is an artist, a professional fixed gear and ultra endurance athlete, a former bike messenger, and simply an overall inspiring person. Besides the Transcontinental Race, Chaz took part in the Atlas Mountain Race, further, and just recently he raced the Stagecoach 400, a self-support mountain bike race. We first met when racing fixed gear crits at the Red Hook Crit Series. While this podcast is going live, Chaz is in fact doing a bikepacking trip with Red Hook Criterium organizer Dave Trimble. So maybe there'll be more than rumors about the comeback of the series soon. Who knows? While we do dwell a little in fixed gear memories, this podcast is about much more than that. Chaz was one of the people that helped me with his advice and encouragement in preparation for the Transcontinental Race. He'd done it with his partner Nico in a team the year before and then raced it again the same year as us. We talk about the spirit of these races, why Mike Hall's mom reached out to them after their first TCR, and why he's always in search of Stoke. But before we start, this podcast has two fantastic supporters that I want to introduce to you. The first one is Velocio, and not only have I tested some of their gear and really like the high quality, I also like them because they take responsibility for their role in sustainable sourcing by seeking out the most environmentally responsible suppliers possible. The jersey collection, for example, is made from recycled fabrics, and Velocio uses biodegradable packaging in their shipping materials. Velocio have asked me to make you aware of this year's Unity project. And this is funny because the first time I got aware of Velocio was through one of their Unity jerseys. Every year, now for the fifth time, they produce a jersey and 100% of the profits will be donated. This year's focus is on climate change and its consequences. There are three selected organizations: the Environmental Justice Foundation, 350.org, and Protect Our Winters. If you want to share Velocio's mission to address climate change and make an important contribution, you can buy this really cool jersey. I really like it. I've seen it already. And yeah, just Google Velocio, or I'll link it in the show notes, and have a look. And you can choose which organization you want the proceeds to go to at the checkout. I think this is absolutely fantastic. Very important, Velocio encourages anyone who doesn't need a jersey right now to donate directly instead of buying another product. Pre-orders for the Unity jersey will be available until May the 31st, so better be quick, and you can expect the delivery in mid-August. Sustainability also plays a big role for my second supporter, Ortlieb Waterproof. Ortlieb is the world's leading brand of waterproof premium equipment. All bags are made in Germany, and that means Ortlieb designs and even builds their own machines. Product management, advertising, purchasing, production, prototyping, warehousing, simply everything takes place in Germany. 70% of the purchasing also takes place in Germany. Since the beginning of the company, Ortlieb has the possibility to repair bags and also offers to update old bags to newer suspension systems. Ortlieb wants the articles to be used for a long time, and therefore they make sure that all individual parts are easily replaceable and they give a 5-year warranty. What I didn't know is that also Chaz has been using Ortlieb waterproof bags for quite a while, since they have been supporting and sponsoring messenger events from the very beginning. And if you want to know more about that, you have to listen to the interview, because Chaz knows everything. So have fun with this interview with Chaz Christensen. To me, it was very special, and I think you will get a feeling of it when you listen to it. are so happy to welcome you on this podcast. We last met in 2018 when we raced the Transcontinental Race. And I can't believe that this is already such a long time ago, almost 3 years. Jess, what have you done since the TCR and how are you doing?
Man, I cannot believe it's been 3 years either. That seems like it was just yesterday. I feel you on that. I've been doing great. You know, since TCR, that was the second ultra endurance race that I'd ever done. I'd done the TCR the year before. And so since then, that kind of started me down this amazing yet kind of painful ultra endurance kind of journey to do a bunch of different ultra endurance races. And I've gone on to do some gravel ultra endurance races. I just completed my first mountain bike ultra endurance race, which is funny because it's something that last time we met, I would have said I would never do mountain bike ultra endurance, only road. But I'm out here doing mountain bike ultra endurance races. So I'm good. I'm kind of continuing along the path of ultra endurance racing. I do think it's worth mentioning that the last time we saw each other was at an ultra endurance race, but we met doing fixed gear racing, fixed gear criteriums. And I still do just a little bit of the fixed gear stuff. I try to, you know, stick to the roots and keep to what started me on this path.
I even remember the very first time I saw you. It was at a Retrocrit pre-party in Barcelona. And you were this superhero I'd only known before from the Mesh videos, from Instagram. And then suddenly you were there and I was really impressed. I'm not sure if I said hello, maybe, and you were really nice. Yeah, that was the very first time at one of those legendary parties in Barcelona.
Those were the best parties. I mean, honestly, I think I love racing my bike and going fast, but I think that the Red Hook parties and the community that it spawned was like my favorite part about those races. But I will be honest, I had probably had a couple beers at that point. So if we did meet, I may not remember because I'm not one of those athletes that abstains from drinking pre-race. I feel like a couple beers usually does me good sometimes.
I think I had some beers too. It was this one where the streets were full with cyclists and the police came to free the streets in front of this cycling shop. I forgot the name, the brand. Really famous. Barcelonian made bicycles, steel, really cool bikes.
Das Noventa bikes. I remember. And that's how you kind of know it's a good party, right? Like if the police show up. If the police don't show up, did you really have a good party? But I think it's so funny because, I mean, cyclists are generally, especially cyclists that race at the Red Hook level, are pretty straight-laced and pretty straightforward people, you know, and a lot of them don't see the police often, are very, you know, kind of live a very structured life. And I think everyone was really, it wasn't a bad thing that the police came. Everyone was like, ooh, like the cops came, we partied so hard, like this is so cool. And it was so cool, but it was just funny because I remember a lot of people being really worried at first, like, oh, are we going to get in trouble? And some other people were like, no, it's fine. They're just going to tell us to go drink someplace else, which is exactly what we did.
Yeah, exactly. Like Barcelona was always the best place. It was warm. We could hang out at the beach and everyone was happy. People were having, like, combining it with a holiday. And yeah. Do you know, have you recently talked to David Trimble? And do you know any rumors about the future?
Yeah, I actually just had coffee with Dave in LA about a month ago. And there are some rumors, but I can't talk about rumors. So I don't know what's up on the record. I don't know what's up for Red Hook in the future. I know that like Mission Crit, which is the San Francisco based fixed gear criterium, is supposed to be happening in September of this year. But I think with COVID, it's really hard for sponsors to get or for organizers to get sponsors to commit when, you know, a new lockdown or, you know, if you move into a different tier of COVID restrictions, a race could get canceled. So I think 2022 is something to look forward to. That's all I can say.
I have to invite him to the podcast. I talked to him a couple of months ago and he said, yeah, let's talk in the podcast maybe. So I have to do it and ask him personally. And he sent me the racing placard, how do you call it in English? The first race where women were allowed to race in Brooklyn, Joe Selzer was on the cover and he sent me that because this was the photograph of the race that made me start racing Retrocrit.
That's so cool that you got that. It's like a race card. Yeah, I think race placard is a good way of putting it. But I remember seeing that, and I love when there's little things, especially little physical things like that, that you can trace back to like being so motivating to you as a person that you did something like kind of scary, which, I mean, racing Red Hook in any capacity is terrifying. But to be, you know, to start racing with all these women who are like super pro and super fast, it's like, that's a really hard thing to do. And I love finding that one thing that motivated, you know, you as a person to go take that big step into the unknown. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I think so too. So I have to put it up the wall. Actually, it might be hanging next to your piece of art that you sent me. I think it's also 2 years ago now, one of your drawings. And yeah, I think when you put it up on your shop, I was like, mine, ordered it directly, and it's still hanging above my desk, and I really love it.
I'm so pumped that you have that piece. I love the piece. It blows me away that people buy my art in any way. But I love it when people that I know buy my art and like frame it, and it looks really good. And that quote, you know, I actually have that quote tattooed on my back. It's kind of it was something that it's from a song, from like a hardcore song. It's a lyrics in a song, and it really resonated with me. But I have that tattooed on me. So I'm glad you have it hanging up on your wall.
It's an amazing quote. Can you re-quote it for us?
I thought the world needed me until I needed the world, is the quote.
And I really love it. When I signed up for the Transcontinental Race, I didn't really know many people who'd done it, not people that I could relate to. And I sent you these, I slid it into your DMs on Instagram. That's how we say it in Germany, and asked you just questions. And you said, oh, if you have basic fitness and if you do like 400 to 500 kilometers per week, roughly, you can do it. And that helped me so much, that someone I could relate to said, yeah, you can do it. So thank you for that.
Totally. I mean, I love that story. And we also call it sliding into the DMs. I think it's hilarious. But I mean, that's one of my favorite things about the kind of the internet, is because like I knew you from fixed gear cycling and the fixed gear racing, and we met a couple times, but yeah, I followed you and I, you know, I saw like how much you rode, and like, you know, it's weird to think that you can get an idea of who a person is through the internet, but I feel like I had a good idea of who you were as a person through the internet. And I wouldn't have said that to everybody. There's definitely people that have slid into the DMs asking about ultra races, and I follow them or I don't, but I'll look at their account and I'll be like, maybe train a little bit, maybe take a year and like, you know, go on a bunch of rides and see if you could actually do this. But you know, even knowing you, having met you through the fixed gear scene and then knowing you through the internet, I had a good idea. You're the type of person in my mind, at least, that maybe you're not 100% ready, but if you can get yourself maybe 60% ready, then your mental strength and your kind of just drive will take you the other 40%. And it was, that's kind of what when I was like, you can do this as long as you can ride your bike, you know, a little bit, some long distances, you got this, is because it's like fitness is only part of races like the Transcontinental. It's a really big mental game. And I feel like you obviously from the finish and, you know, from how you've progressed since then, have the mental capacity and the strength to do it. And I think that's what a lot of people don't realize, is they think that races like the Transcontinental is all about just being fit and being able to ride, you know, 300K a day every day. But really, it's about, you know, your mental capacity and your ability to just keep going. And if things go wrong, which you and I both know things will always go wrong on ultra endurance races, is your ability to just kind of roll with the punches and keep moving forward.
Yeah, that's what it is about. And you knew, I mean, you, the very first Transcontinental that you and Nico raced, I think it was also because you were on a strict timetable, but you didn't finish it. So you came back to finish the business, didn't you?
Yeah, that was tough for us because we, you know, we had no idea about the Transcontinental or the ultra race scene. Or even Mike Hall, really, you know, the whole thing about it. And Pedaled, the cycling kit company, kind of offered us to race this race. And, you know, essentially they described it to us. And me and Nico were like, this is a big alley cat. you know, we were bike messengers for so long, and an alley cat is a street race in a city where they give you a bunch of addresses and you have to make it to all the addresses in order. And the first person to get done wins, and you can pick your own route. And if you look at the transcontinental, it's just an alley cat across Europe. You know, you start in a city and they give you four checkpoints, parkours to get to in order, and you can route yourself between all of them. And the first person to get to the finish is the winner. And we were like, yeah, this is just bigger than what we normally do. And so we started it, not really understanding the gravity of the situation, definitely not understanding that the transcontinental was kind of the biggest of the ultra endurance races, kind of like a championship, if you will. And we had already committed to going to the Cycle Messenger World Championships in Montreal immediately after. We planned to do the race in 14 days. And if everything lined up perfectly, we would finish the transcontinental, get on a plane, fly to Montreal, land, and then compete in the Cycle Messenger World Championships. But like I just said, and like you know, things never go to plan, especially when you're doing something you've never done before. So we got behind schedule, essentially, and we made it to the fourth checkpoint up the Transfăgărașan in Romania, and we had realized that like we weren't going to make it to the finish in time to basically make it to Montreal for the Cycle Messenger World Championships. And to us, it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, we were just like, oh, this is a race. Like, you know, we didn't get to finish it. We had a great time. We had a crazy adventure riding across Europe, obviously. But we just kind of were like, we have this other commitment. You know, we're bike messengers first and foremost. This is our world championships. We have to go compete in this huge event, you know, happens every year. And it wasn't until we like scratched from the race and like flew to do this. And everybody was like, what are you doing? Like, this is sacrilege. I remember James Mark Hayden had some very critical things to say about us, rightfully so. And me and James are really good friends now. And you know, a lot of people had a lot of really kind of not nasty, but very, very critical things to say about our choice to do that. And we just had no idea kind of what we were doing, which is a good and a bad thing. And I think the one thing that really helped us or stuck out in my mind is that Mike Hall's mom actually reached out to us and was like, and told us, she was like, Mike would think this is okay. Like, you guys did a really good job. You have other things going on. Like, just, this is fine. Like, enjoy your life. Have a good race. You know, good luck and Godspeed, essentially. And so we went, and Nico actually got third place in the world championships that year. I think I got seventh or eighth. We showed up the day that the championship started, super jet lag and exhausted from racing the TCR, and competed in a messenger championship on our TCR race bikes, you know, with our aero bars and everything still installed. But when we got done with all that and we came home, both of us were like, that was amazing. And that was an amazing experience. Like, and we feel really bad that we didn't understand the gravity of the situation that we were in. We just kind of, you know, we were kind of like ignorant. We were like little kids that were just kind of in a, you know, little kid stumbles into a party and they don't really know what's going on. And everyone at the party is like, what are you doing, little kid? And so the next year we were like, we have to go back and we have to finish this. It was something that we felt like we owed it to the memory of Mike. We owed it to the seriousness of ultra racing. We owed it to ourselves to go back and take it more seriously and fully realize how big of a deal racing something like the Transcontinental is and give it kind of the respect that it deserves.
So why does one not just step out of a bike race like the Transcontinental race?
I think it's personal for every person, but I think the reason that someone doesn't just step out of it is because of the amount of time and planning that it takes to step into it. And that's something that we missed, is that when we did our first Transcontinental, we didn't do the registration process. We didn't do the application. We didn't do all of this stuff. We basically got invited to participate about a month before the race. So we didn't have what I now know is, you know, it takes 6 to 8 months to prepare for something like the Transcontinental. There's the application process, then you get in, and then there's the route planning, and there's all the gear selection, and then the training. We didn't have any of that. We just kind of stepped into it. And obviously, if you look at our routes, if you look at our track from that race, our routing was horrid. We broke all the rules from the race because we didn't really understand, you know, riding on banned roads. We didn't do anything dangerous. We made it over a bunch of stupid mountain passes that we shouldn't have gone over. And there was one point in Slovakia where half the race course went north and the other half of the race pack went south. And we were the only racers that went through the middle. And everyone was, you know, hitting us up on Instagram and texting us and emailing us being like, what are you guys doing? You know, our gear was totally, we had none of the right gear. We didn't know what we were doing. But I now realize that the gravity of the situation is that people put so much time and energy to participate in a race like that. And I think us leaving was kind of a slap in the face of people that took it really seriously. As in like, hey, who are these two yahoos that just came in and treated this thing like it was just a big party and it's just a big, you know, kind of a joke. I think people thought we were treating it like a joke. And we weren't, because we took it seriously, but the community that we come from, the Bike Messenger community and kind of where we come from, is that you don't take things super seriously. And then me and Nico as people are generally very chill. And, you know, it's not about the competition. It's about the experience and about, you know, the process. Like, the journey is more important than the destination. And so for us, we got what we wanted out of the first Transcontinental. We, you know, had an amazing adventure. We rode our bikes across Europe for 11 days or 12 days and, you know, saw all this crazy stuff and did all these crazy things. But I now see that it does mean a lot more to a lot of people. And having spent, you know, registered and done the whole process the next year and done a bunch of other ultra endurance races, I could see how it would be really frustrating to see some people drop out of a race, not because they were injured and they had to scratch or all these other reasons that are very legitimate, but because they were like, oh, we have to go race this other race that's like more important in our mind. But I think that's also just part of the learning process. And I think it was good for us to kind of get checked by a lot of people. And, you know, if I do something wrong, I want people to tell me that I did something wrong. So, and like I said, nobody got nasty about it. Nobody was like insulting. They were just like, you guys have no idea what you're doing. Like, you're kind of making a poor choice, a poor look. And they were just kind of telling us that. And, you know, we responded in kind and we talked to everyone. And then that's where we came back the next year and we were like, okay, we get it. Like, we're going to make up for our kind of flippant attitude the first year by coming back and taking it really seriously.
Great. And you know what? I mean, we did do dot watching the year before, me and my partner. And also we like looked at Instagram and saw you guys doing it in your fun and crazy way. And maybe that was one of the reasons why we started too, because I mean, you didn't finish and yeah, you had other priorities, but you still showed the race to us.
Yeah, I think that nowadays that's something that I really strive to do specifically. I think in the first Transcontinental, we didn't specifically try to show people the lighter side of ultra endurance racing. That was just we just shared our experience in a very transparent way. But I think most people, when they come into races like the Transcontinental or ultra endurance racing, they take it very, very seriously, which is rightfully so. You spend 6 to 8 months, a year preparing, training for this race. It's a very serious thing. But I worry that some people think that the new people coming into ultra endurance racing or any bike racing, think that you have to take things seriously to do it well. And I think I really tried and show people that you can take things serious enough, but you can remain kind of, you know, a lighthearted attitude about it. And it can be a fun, enjoyable thing. And you can still do something well and you can still finish. Like, it doesn't all have to be hard. It doesn't, you know, it's not always about embracing the suck. There can be a lot of very happy moments. And there's also a lot of, you know, very dark moments. You have to take the highest highs and the lowest lows. But I think a lot of people who race really focus on the lowest lows. And it's a lot about kind of a masochistic, like, self-punishment or how much can I endure? Whereas I would rather highlight the highest highs and be like, this is amazing. Like, there are some, I've had some of my greatest life experiences racing ultra endurance races. I've also felt the worst I've ever felt in my entire life racing ultra endurance races. But I want to show people that, you know, you don't have to take things so serious that there's no enjoyment in it to experience something like this. You can come into it with a light heart, take it seriously, but also, you know, have a really good time and enjoy yourself. And it can be more about the personal experience and the personal growth than the result, the end result, or, you know, kind of punishing yourself for the sake of the result.
Yeah, I mean, I tolerate people who like punishing themselves, and I was one of them in the past. I mean, I played a couple of years in my life, or more, 20 years of rugby. But this podcast is a lot about having fun, and it does help. You're more successful quite often too, because it does help you to finish these races too.
I agree. I think that, I mean, the punishing yourself and trying hard is, it's a great thing. But if you're not enjoying yourself, I just think, not what's the point, but I think it's hard for people to continue to do something for a long time if they're not having a good time. And I think as we get older, especially, we come to that realization where you critically think and you're like, if I'm not really enjoying myself, like, why am I doing this? So I want to make sure that I enjoy myself so that I continue to do, you know, all these things that I love. With, you know, I think the punishing yourself is there's a certain joy in that too. I think anyone that participates in endurance sports understands that part of it is you pushing your body to a limit, maybe pushing it past the limit and learning how to kind of deal with the physical pain and mentally getting yourself to keep pushing, which is a kind of a joy in its own right.
It is. Pain is not always bad. I agree there too. And you just recently raced the Stagecoach 400, a mountain bike race. And I feel you when you say, oh, you would never have imagined racing a mountain bike race. So how come?
Oh, honestly, for fun. That was kind of the thing is I started since COVID, everything, you know, changed. All of our normal schedules and our normal races and everything we had planned stopped. And all of the races that I had planned were ultra endurance, gravel and road races. And then all of a sudden I'm stuck in California for a year and a half. And I will fully admit that California is a great place to be stuck. So it was great to be here because I had all of California to explore. And so I just started going on bike tours, and I started going on, you know, very transcontinental-esque bike tours, very road bikes, you know. But then it became immediately obvious that that was irresponsible with the lockdowns, going into convenience stores, you know, all the restaurants are closed. It just didn't feel right seeing all these people and interacting with all these people during COVID. And so the solution was to just start going on dirt tours and to start packing all of the food you need for the whole tour so you don't have to go to any stores and you filter your own water. And it became way more self-sufficient. So I went from riding, you know, like my road bike with 28C tires to my gravel bike with, you know, 700 by 40C tires, fully loaded. And then as I was doing these, I started to realize, I was like, I don't have enough room and I'm not really able to go where I want to go with this gravel bike. And in California, and I'm sure in most places because of COVID, the outdoors became incredibly popular because people couldn't go to malls. They couldn't do all of these indoor leisure activities. So everybody went camping. And so that meant in California, at least, that all of the trails that I knew of or all the routes were just packed with people. So many people, you know, 10 times more people than they'd ever been were outside. So I essentially had to find routes that were more remote to get farther away from people. And so kind of not being able to carry all the gear I wanted to carry on my bike, not being able to ride the routes that were really, really far away. I had a mountain bike that I never rode. Yeah, I've had it for 2 years, 3 years, I think, and I rode it 4 times. And eventually I kind of looked at it and I was like, I bet I could fit a lot more snacks on that mountain bike. I could go a lot more crazy places. And so I did. I packed my first mountain bike, bike packing, and it was really good. And it was the challenge for me was learning to go slower, because obviously on a mountain bike, if you're doing 10 miles an hour average over a day, that's really fast. And if you're doing 10 miles an hour a day on a road bike or a transcontinental, that's super slow. And you're like, you're not doing very well. So learning to chill out, was hard for me, but being able to be more self-sufficient and go more remote places was great. And so I just started doing more and more of these mountain bike packing tours where I would pack, you know, 4 days worth of food in my bags and bring a water filter and just ride to some crazy remote places and not see anyone for 4 days. And then they announced the Stagecoach 400, which is a mountain bike ultra endurance race in Southern California. I think this is the 11th or the 12th year that it's been held. And they announced it that they were going to hold it with kind of COVID restrictions, but it was essentially the first opportunity to race an ultra endurance race, since COVID started. And especially since it was in Southern California, I didn't have to get on a plane because I don't really feel like flying for bike races right now is super responsible. I think that, you know, it's not worth risking myself or others for something that's essentially a leisure activity. So for me, I was like, I can drive to this race. I've been doing this in a very leisurely way. All the bikepacking tours that I got on with my mountain bike were, you know, I'd bring a six pack. I'd bring all the food. It was like, I was not going fast. It was all about comfort and, you know, having all the snacks. And so this Stagecoach was an opportunity to take this skill set that I developed over COVID, mountain bike, bikepacking essentially, and then combined it with the racing elements of like a transcontinental where, you know, you don't carry a stove, you are eating, you know, not very good food. It's all based on like super lightweight, very efficient speed, and kind of combined the two in an ultra race. And I mean, for me, it was that and also just wanting to race something, anything. And the Stagecoach was that, the race that was like, oh, this is the only race I can do, so I'll do it.
Yeah, it's very smart. And I think many of us have thought the same ways and getting away from the people. But also mountain bike had this, how do I call it? Let me give you an example. The Atlas Mountain Race or the Silk Road Mountain Race. I mean, they are kind of called gravel race because they, maybe not anymore, but in the beginning, because gravel was hot and mountain bike wasn't. And now people start to realize that it's quite fun and you can carry more snacks, which is important when you go by a mountain bike, like when you use a mountain bike. So maybe there's a new trend. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I think that almost anything you can do on a gravel bike, you can do on a mountain bike better. And for me, I really learned that the hard way when I went to race Atlas Mountain, in the very beginning of 2020, like right before COVID. I flew to Morocco to race the Atlas Mountain race. It was a really rough race. I went to race it with Nico as a pair. He broke his carbon fork on his gravel bike the first like 18 hours into the race. So then all of a sudden I was solo, but I was on a gravel bike and I had 650. Wheels with 48 tires, so 650 by 48, which is a very big tire, almost a two inch mountain bike tire, essentially. But it was just painful. I just got punished the entire race, and you know the climbing was hard because I had the craziest, you know, SRAM gearing that I could get for a gravel bike, but it still wasn't enough. I was walking up a lot of the climbs. The descents were just bone rattling, and the mountains in Morocco are huge. So some of the descents were like 15 mile descents. And I remember just finishing these descents and I couldn't feel my hands for like 20 minutes because they were just so numb. It was so painful. And I ended up scratching from that race. I fell hiking up a mountain. I fell and twisted my leg and landed on it wrong and raced for two more days. And then eventually was in too much pain and like, you know, stopped racing. But the one thing that I took away from that race was, get a mountain bike. It's so much more comfortable to be in the mountain bike position and have the flat bars for these types of races. Like, yes, you can do it on a gravel bike, but it's so much better on a mountain bike. And so for me, I think that was the big thing, is like, it's more comfortable. And honestly, I think when you're more comfortable in a lot of scenarios, you can go faster. Just because you're not fighting the bike, you're able to use the bike to help you as opposed to like kind of battling the bike the whole way. And so I think a lot of people are just also starting to realize that, yes, you can do it on a gravel bike, but would you want to? Maybe you should just get a mountain bike and be more comfortable.
Yeah. So from fixed gear to road bike to gravel bike to mountain bike, I can see like a development.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because if you had asked me even 5 years ago if I would ever do like a mountain bike bikepacking race, I would have just laughed at you and been like, yeah, no way. I don't ride mountain bikes. But it is a development, and a lot of it is just, you know, I try to push myself and do things that I'm uncomfortable with and that honestly scare me. Cause riding mountain bikes, I'm terrified of that. Flying down a trail with trees and rocks, I feel so out of control and I feel so vulnerable and I enjoy it, but I honestly, it's something that's really challenging for me. Like put me on a track bike in traffic and I'm like a fish in water. I have no fear. I'm super confident. And I know that that's kind of ironic, is that I would rather race a brakeless bike in traffic with cars that could hit me and everything's moving and it's super kind of fluid and nothing's predictable than ride on a trail with, you know, trees that aren't moving and have brakes and I have all the gears and all this stuff. But riding a mountain bike honestly kind of terrifies me still. So one of the things that I keep on coming back to is, you know, I want to always want to try and expand myself and do things that are new. And a mountain bike is just, yeah, that new thing. So I think you're right. It is a progression from track bikes to road bikes to gravel bikes to mountain bikes. I just think it's funny that I started with track bikes. And I think that they're the easiest because I think for a lot of people, riding a brakeless bike with one gear is as terrifying as riding a mountain bike is to me.
Yeah. But I can totally feel you here because like there's nothing on a track bike. You just have this one gear and you, when you, if you have the skills, you know how to control it. And in mountain biking, I mean, there's just the surface, I think that terrifies me most because you really have to let go. The secret is to roll and not brake or brake very little and very, specifically. But yeah, you let go and you, that's something you don't do when racing fixed gear bikes, track bikes.
And isn't that crazy? We came from racing brakeless bikes where we don't have brakes, but we have the hardest time not braking on bikes that have brakes. I get it. It's terrifying. I think it's really funny.
Maybe one day we can resume about it and say, yeah, now we can close the circle. Now we all know why, how it makes sense. But we're still going further. And I'm curious where we will end, if the mountain bike is the last bike station or how it would go from there. But how did you actually get into track cycling?
It's actually really funny that I got into track cycling or track bikes from cyclocross, of all places. I was living in Portland, Oregon in 2005, and I got a cyclocross bike. Just needed a bike from a bike shop, and went in and they sold me a cyclocross bike because it was, you know, the mix of road and mountain bikes. And, I was just riding that to work. I worked as a dishwasher and a prep cook at a big fancy restaurant. And one of the servers, one of the waiters at the restaurant, saw my bike and he was like, you know, that's a race bike for racing cyclocross. And I was like, I have no idea what cyclocross is, but I like racing. So what's up? He's like, let's go. And he took me to a race. And in Portland, Oregon, it's very much like the roots of cyclocross in Belgium, where it's super rainy and super muddy and the fans go crazy. And I showed up to this cyclocross race, you know, having no idea what I was doing. And it was amazing. You know, 8 inches of mud. So all this crazy racing, fans everywhere, screaming, yelling, the whole cyclocross, you know, vibe was going on. And I was like, this is amazing. And then everyone was wearing kits and everyone looked so pro. And then there was this group of people that were wearing cutoff shorts and t-shirts and they, you know, had 12 packs of beer and they were like just kind of drunk and racing around. And I was like, who are those guys? Cause that's more my vibe. Like that was the thing as I looked at all the people in their fancy kits and everything. And I was like, that's intimidating. These people are wearing shorts and t-shirts. It's pouring down rain and they're drunk and they're riding around. And I noticed that some of them had bikes with no gears and no brakes, or that they didn't stop pedaling. And I was like, what is going on? And someone, the guy I went with, was like, those are bike messengers. They're kooks. Like, you don't want to go hang out with those guys. And I didn't, because I was terrified of them because they were super intimidating, but I wanted to. I was like, oh man, like, what is up with that? And so all winter I rode my bike around and I started to notice bike messengers more from that cyclocross race. I was like, okay, there's these people, and I would see them on their brakeless track bikes. And at that point, I didn't have any idea what a track bike was. I was just like, these bikes that don't stop pedaling and don't have brakes and only have one gear. And I remember I built essentially like a single speed. I had an old road bike and I took all the derailleur and everything off. And I left the cassette on and I just tensioned the chain kind of. And I would go ride around and I would skid. You know, I had brakes and I had on a single speed and I would just ride around and like skid and be like, yeah, I'm like looking like these crazy bike messenger guys. And finally, I moved into this house, like this punk house, with somebody who actually knew about fixed gears. And I'm still really good friends with this woman. Her name's Arielle Raymond. And she gave me my first fixed wheel. And she was like, what are you doing with this single speed with brakes skidding? Like, what are you doing? And I was like, it's cool. It's like bike messengers. And she's like, No, that's not like you're not being cool. And she gave me my first fixed wheel, and then, you know, the rest is kind of history from there. But yeah, I cyclocross, and then this really amazing woman that I know a long time ago gave me a fixed wheel, and here I am today.
And you started working as a messenger too. And I mean, you already mentioned at the Messenger World Championships. I have a few friends who are also messengers. And then you also had your own messenger company, if I researched correctly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when I was living in Portland, I graduated from the dishwasher prep cook to a butcher. I was working in a butcher shop for a couple years. And I liked the job, but I was at that point racing alley cats. I had gotten a track bike, and I was racing like street races, messenger street races. So I knew a lot of the messengers, and I was like, these guys and women are the coolest people ever. You get paid to ride your bike. And I remember the day that one of the messengers came up to me and was like, hey, I'm moving to New York. Do you want my job? And I was like, yes, like instantly, like, yes. I took a huge pay cut. The butcher shop paid great. It had great hours. It was a great place to work. And I got paid half as much to ride around in the rain in Portland all winter and freeze. But I loved it. I was like, this is amazing. I don't make any money, but I don't have a boss. And you know, you give me this cool radio and I just get to ride my track bike all day. And I did 2 winters as a messenger in Portland before I moved to San Francisco. And I only moved to San Francisco because that was a bigger messenger city. And I was so enamored. I was so in love with bike messaging and the culture that I was like, I just want to be part of this more. And San Francisco was just a bigger, had more messengers. You got paid a little more. It was just the place to be in my mind if you rode track bikes. This is kind of when MASH was starting to. So I was like, this MASH thing is happening there. This is, if you like track bikes, like San Francisco is the place to be. And I loved track bikes. So I moved to San Francisco, and I actually attended, shortly after moving to San Francisco in 2008, I went to the 2009 European Cycle Messenger Championships in Berlin. They threw it at Tempelhof, and that was the first time that I traveled internationally. I had been to Mexico for like some family vacations, but I had never been to Europe. I was 23 years old, I think. And I went to England. I flew to London, spent a week with the bike messengers in London, and then went to Berlin. And just had the most amazing time. Like, the community was amazing. I didn't know anybody. I showed up not knowing anybody. And all these young Berlin bike messengers and just fixed gear kids were like, cool, you ride a bike? You're our age. You like to drink beer? Like, we're best friends, you know? And the racing at Tempelhof was unlike any racing I'd ever experienced. The community, I was basically hooked. The European Cycle Messenger Championships, which is very much like the World Cycle Messenger Championships, was really what solidified into me that this was something that I wanted to do with my life. And so I came back from that and worked as a messenger, and then started my own messenger company in San Francisco called TCB Courier, and ran that for almost 10 years. I ran for 9 years and competed in messenger championships around the world, and really kind of immersed myself fully into the community of bike messaging. It's an amazing worldwide community of people. I kind of, from, you know, the bike messaging community, Red Hook really kind of came out of that in a way. Red Hook didn't come from bike messengers, but I think the bike messenger street racing community really kind of helped Red Hook form a little bit. And you know, I spent almost 15 years of my life in the bike messenger community. And even now I don't work as a bike messenger anymore. And the company that I ran is no longer running, but I still run some bike messenger software. It's just back-end logistics software to run a bike messenger company. We have got, I think, 46 companies that use it around the world. And so I'm still a part of the bike messenger community in some small way, because I help run the software that a lot of companies use to operate every day.
Very cool. And what is it that makes it so special, the community? What is it? Because I know, I mean, I have friends who say the same, but it's really hard from the outside to feel. Why is it so special?
I think the thing to me that makes the bike messenger community so special is its inclusiveness, which is weird, because if you look at the bike messenger community as an outsider, it seems super non-inclusive. And it seems like this cool kid club of, you know, like all these kids, all these people that think they're better than you because they're like, oh, I ride a bike for a living, which in reality is like, cool, you do kind of a blue collar, you know, very working class job. You pick things up and drop it off for other people that have more money and don't have the time. But the inclusiveness comes from, as long as you work hard and are a good person, you are fully accepted. And I really appreciate the fact that it doesn't matter what color skin you have. It doesn't matter your sexual orientation. It doesn't matter how you dress. As long as you work hard and you're a good person, you have a community around the world. Anywhere you go, any city I've been to, especially pre-smartphones, I would just go to like the downtown. Like when I first came to Berlin for the first time in 2009, I just went downtown to Mitte and waited till I saw somebody on a track bike wearing an Ortlieb messenger bag and rode up to them and was like, I'm a bike messenger from San Francisco. I just got here. Can you help me? And I ended up staying on that person's couch for a week. They were like, yeah, here's the keys to my house. What do you need? And it was just instantly that, like, if you're part of this community, you have a family around the whole world. And it takes a little bit to get into, which I think is, you know, you have to work hard. Your reputation in the bike messenger community is based on how hard you work and if you're a good person. And I think those are to me as a person, as a human being, those are two of the most important things that I measure people by in any capacity. Is bike messengers or someone I meet on the street, how hard do you work? And if you're a good person, if you treat other people well. And so I think that part of the bike messenger scene, really having those kind of barriers to entry, but then also having this amazing family around the world, I think that's super attractive to a lot of people.
I get goosebumps listening to it. And I've heard these things, but it's really, really, truly special. So how is it to stop working as a messenger? I mean, you said you are still involved due to the logistics and your software. So are you still part? How is it? Like, are you in or out? Or
stopping being a bike messenger is like stopping doing a drug, I think, especially if you've done it for a really long time. There's withdrawals. You get so used to living this freedom, this life of, you know, your bike messaging is one of the most freeing jobs, I think, because as long as you do your job, like I said, as long as you work hard and your packages aren't late, you can do whatever you want. And the city is there every day for you to explore and, you know, everything is different. And so like I work on the software side of it now. And most of my involvement with the bike messenger community is answering technical support emails from company owners or from riders that are having problems, or helping new companies get set up, which is the part I enjoy the most, is helping new small companies get set up and helping them figure out how to navigate starting a business, you know, getting clients, invoicing, billing, all of the kind of mundane things that come from running a small business. But helping a bike messenger start their own thing and taking ownership of something. But luckily, in my personal life, when I stopped working as a bike messenger, it's kind of when I stepped into being an influencer full time. And I really hate the term influencer, but I also, that is what I do. You know, I hate that that's my job title, but I also want to be fully honest about it. And that's, you know, I work with brands to influence people to buy their products. And I only work with brands that I love and I like their product. I feel good supporting these brands and I feel good encouraging people to buy their products, but that is my job now, my full-time job. And so luckily I was able to move from bike messaging into that, which has kind of the same aspects of bike messaging in terms of I'm my own boss. I set my own schedule. Every day is different. And as long as I do the things that I need to do, as long as I fulfill the obligations that I have to the sponsors and the people that pay me, I can kind of do whatever I want with my day. So it's leaving bike messaging is a hard thing to do for a lot of people. And I think I was just really lucky that when I left, I was able to step into something that was very similar and allowed me to kind of still be who I am and do what I want to do with my life.
And I can imagine that it doesn't really go with racing so well either, because, I mean, if you're a bike messenger, you have to perform 5 days or I don't know, 4 or 5, however much you want to work. But if you crash your bike on the weekend, you can't work. It's not really something that yeah, gives you much safety, security as a job. I mean, is that maybe part of the change as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that works if you're young. If you're in your early 20s, it's amazing. Because you ride 5 days a week, you're working full time on the bike, and then you go and race all weekend. And I think for me, it worked really well. I was very, 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 very strong in my 20s because I was a bike messenger. But there was definitely a point in my late 20s, 28, 29, kind of when Red Hook was really starting to really pick up, that I realized that I couldn't work full time as a bike messenger and compete at the level that Red Hook was at, or, you know, a semi-pro or a pro race level. Because physically it's almost just impossible to recover. There's no recovery time if you're working 5 days a week and then racing over the weekends. And then the safety thing is a huge thing. You know, if you hurt yourself racing and you can't work as a bike messenger, then you don't pay the bills, you don't pay rent, and vice versa. If you hurt yourself as a bike messenger, you're not racing bikes over the weekend. So it's a tough thing to do, but I think if you're in your early 20s, and you have, you know, unlimited energy. I know that you're roughly my age, so you understand what it's like to remember what it is to be in your 20s. It's a great thing, and I encourage people to do it when they can, because there's definitely a point pretty soon after you turn 26, 27 that it's not possible anymore, or not as easy. I shouldn't say it's not possible. Anything's possible. It's not nearly as easy to do.
Yeah. The downside of growing older, or maybe it's also okay. I mean, priorities change, and it's not fun to do the same thing all the time anyway. So you talked and you call yourself an influencer, which I think is really cool. I do the same sometimes. If I feel like, I say I'm an influencer too. And the funny thing here is that I introduced you into the beginning of the podcast, and I like it wouldn't even come in my mind to call you an influencer, because for me, you're an artist, you're a cyclist, you're a racer, an ultra cyclist. This shows me that you must have found a really good balance on your channel. So it does not seem to annoy me, and I'm quite picky when it comes to these things. And yeah, so have you ever had trouble with that?
You know, honestly, a little bit, coming from the bike messenger community, like how I talked about, you know, the bike messenger community as a family. I think the only trouble that I've gotten from really stepping into being an influencer full time is from my family, as will generally happen. I got a lot of judgment for, you know, selling out and, you know, kind of being like, oh, you work for all these big companies, like you're no longer part of the streets. And, you know, I think that they're right. And I think that that's part of growing up and changing. Like you said, people grow up and they change. And I definitely came from the streets, and I, you know, there was a point in my life when I never would have worked with a big company, or I never would have taken any money from anybody to do anything. But there was, as I grew up and things changed, I started to realize that, you know, working as a bike messenger, making minimum wage, or even when I ran my own company, you know, and I honestly made less money running my own company than I did just working. Anybody that runs their own business will tell you it's not a great way to get rich quick. I realized that, you know, if I was going to continue to live this life that I wanted to live, I had to get paid. I had to pay the bills. I had to figure out how to make ends meet and make it sustainable. And so I started working with these companies and brands that I you know, I like their product. Like Oakley has been my longest sponsor. And I, you know, I need glasses. I can't see without them. I have prescription glasses, and I love their prescription glasses. I love their product. I enjoy where the company is and what the company does, and any of the brands that I work with. And I hope that I like that you say that I find a good balance, because I don't want to push things down people's throats. But I also, you know, I have to pay the bills, and I'm lucky enough to have a job that I can share what I like with people. But I think it's important to be honest about things. And, you know, I am an artist, and that does pay the bills sometimes. And I do race bikes, and I do all these things, but I think it's important to show people that, you know, Instagram is like perfect, right? Instagram is all the best parts of life, and it doesn't show any of the like kind of real life things that happen for the most part. And I want to make sure that people know that, you know, I do this to pay the bills, and I love it, and it's a great job, but it is still a job. And, you know, I don't want people to think that this stuff just all comes easily, or just kind of, you know, like gifts just shower down from the sky and I have all these amazing things. It's like, no, this is a job, and it, you know, it's a cool job, but still something that I do for a living.
Yeah. I saw that you painted on an Ortlieb bag. Ortlieb is produced in Germany, and they are actually supporting this episode. I'm not sure if I told you before. I don't think so. And they, when I told them that you will be the guest, they were like really happy. And yeah, and you painted on some bags, and you used them in the Stagecoach 400 as well, like the fork bags I saw, or you tested them.
Yeah, I mean, Ortlieb.
So there is a connection.
There is. And I mean, that's one of those things where, like, I love working with brands that I love. And I got my first Ortlieb bag in 2006. I still have it. It is not waterproof anymore. And that's okay because it's, you know, 15 years old. But I still have it. And I love Ortlieb products. I think that's one of those situations where, like, Ortlieb is a company that makes really, really solid products that last for a long time and they work really well. And so when the opportunity came to create some art on some of their bags, I was immediately like, yes, like, A, I love the company. I love the product. Being able to draw on them would be fantastic. And this is, I am actually not technically sponsored by Ortlieb. They do not pay me any money, but I will 100% say that I think that their bikepacking bags are some of the best bikepacking bags on the market from my experiences. I've used a ton of different bags for a very long time, and I always come back to the Ortlieb bags because they're just, you know, they're 100% waterproof and they always keep your stuff dry and they last a long time. And so I really appreciate when a company takes the time to create a really solid product that works and do a lot of testing. And I'm lucky enough to get a lot of their products before they go to production and give feedback. And I love it when you see feedback that you've given appear in a production bag. I think it's really important for companies to listen to the people that use the product. And I think Ortlieb does a really good job of that. But ultimately, I mean, I think Ortlieb to me has also just been that iconic messenger company, you know, especially in Europe, you know, and, you know, being from Germany, you have seen, I'm sure every bike messenger had an Ortlieb bag, you know, usually of a cool color, like the yellow or the red. They had these bags. Ortlieb has been sponsoring and supporting bike messengers since the 90s. So it is really cool to work with a company like that from bike messaging and like the urban cycling to now being able to use their products on all these crazy like, kind of bikepacking adventures that I do.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. I mean, I know the bags, I've seen them, but I didn't know that they were so close to the messenger scene.
It's 1998, first Cycle Messenger World Championships. Ortlieb sponsored them and made custom bags. Yeah, Ortlieb is one of the few companies that has been there since the very beginning. And I think it's funny. I love it that they don't flex on that. I feel like so many companies would be like, we've been part of this since the very beginning. And that's like, you know, we do this, but Ortlieb's, they don't have to like, you know, they don't have to put it out there. It's just kind of a known thing. Or yeah, they just they're like, yeah, of course we've been supporting these people since the very beginning. You know, they need our product. We make a good product. They need our good product. And you know, it just kind of made sense.
This is crazy now that you, an American, has to tell me, a German, the history of Ortlieb.
That's only because I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to bike messenger bags. My partner loves to hate on me for it, but I have so many bike messenger bags, like probably over 50 bike messenger bags. I know I don't wear them anymore. I'm not a bike messenger. I wear a backpack sometimes, but I have all these crazy bags. Because it's, you know, it's a huge part of who I was for so long. So I kept, they're all in Tupperware containers in my basement. I keep them and I, you know, pull them out and look at them every once in a while and take a trip down memory lane.
Okay, so I know who's opening the Bike Messenger Museum when you have done racing and everything.
Oh, it's going to happen. I have saved, I'm kind of a hoarder. I will fully admit that I place far too much value on physical items, but I at some point I would actually love to have a bike messenger like fixed gear museum. I have luckily been able, I was able to work with Chinelli and Mash for so long during their relationship, and I have the prototypes of every Chinelli Mash frame ever made. And it's cool because they were all made, you know, the Chinelli frames are made in Taiwan or in Southeast Asia, but all the prototypes are handmade in Italy, and they had an Italian frame builder build all of these prototypes. And then when Mash was working with them, and one of the reasons that working with Chinelli was so amazing is during that time, we would pitch them an idea, like the Parallax, and they would send us a prototype, and then we would ride it, and we would give them feedback, and then they would send us another prototype, and they were willing to go through the prototyping process multiple times for us to get it right. And I think that's why some of the bikes that Mash and Shinelli made are so good, is because sometimes there was three or four prototypes of a bike before it hit production, because they would send us one and we would all, myself and the rest of the Mash team, would ride it and be like, you know, we like this, we don't like this. And they'd be like, okay. And they'd make another one. But I have all of the prototypes in my basement. They're all banged up, but they're there. So one day I'll put them in a museum. It'll be great.
That is so cool. Talking about Mash, can you tell us a little bit more, like, who started Mash?
Mash started with Mike Martin and Gabe Morford. And Mike Martin still runs Mash to this day, as most people know. Gabe Morford, for those that don't know, is probably one of the best skateboard photographers out there. He's a very humble person. But he is, in terms of skateboarding, he's like skateboarding royalty. He's been shooting skate photography and skate videos since the 90s. He's hugely influential in skateboarding. And him and Mike were friends, and they, you know, kind of just started this video project based around people riding track bikes in San Francisco, most of them being bike messengers. They produced the first Mash video. And then from that, kind of developed the team, although that was never, I think, the intent of Mike, to create a race team. He just wanted to support the people that he knew in the scene and had met through filming. And so he, you know, kind of started supporting a lot of us, myself, Rainier Schaefer, Walton Brush, Kyle Murphy, you know, a lot of the original Mash riders. And then Red Hook really gave us an opportunity to kind of coalesce and become a team, and bring some sponsorship support in. But ultimately, I think Mash is a brand that Mike runs as a creative outlet, because Mike is an incredibly creative person. And it's a way for him to kind of share his creativity through all the amazing stuff that he makes, but also as a way to support kind of grassroots racing and support people. You know, because for us, it was, you know, none of us ever got a paycheck for Mash, but he flew us around the world. You know, he got sponsors too, and sometimes he paid out of his own pocket to fly us all over the world to go to races and just have experiences and have a good time. So yeah, Mash is kind of an amazing thing. It's kind of an anomaly, I think, in the bike industry, for something that was never really there to make a ton of money. It was there to support people and kind of uplift people, you know, provide opportunity.
And what's Mash doing nowadays?
You know, Mash is kind of just, I don't know. Mash is just kind of doing Mash. Mike, you know, with the COVID, it was tough. But he's still just making cool stuff. You know, he does a lot of small t-shirt designs and small goods. He's producing his own frames, which are amazing. And that has been an honor to be a part of kind of developing and helping Mike produce Mash frames.
At some stage, they separated from Shinelli.
Yeah, Mash and Shinelli parted ways maybe 3 years ago. I think the relationship had just run its course. And Mike wanted to take a little more creative control and make his own frames. And so the frames that have come out in the last couple of years are Mash frames, designed by Mash, tested by myself and all the other Mash riders. They are made in Taiwan, but almost everything in the bike industry is made in Taiwan now, and the factories over there do amazing work. But yeah, we're working on, you know, an all-road bike, a gravel bike, a mountain bike, and Mike's really just kind of trying to expand the offerings that he has for Mash, keeping it small. You know, none of the frame runs are more than 200 frames, so it's all very small scale, but it's good. I think it's become less about the team. You know, we're still kind of a team, quote unquote, but we don't really go to races that much together anymore. And there's not nearly as much sponsor support, but we're still ultimately still just a group of friends that ride. It's kind of full circle. We started as a group of friends that were riding without any support, and now we're still just a group of friends that are riding without a ton of support. But that's because most of us, almost all of us, have grown up and don't really need the support anymore. So yeah, Mash is doing good. Mash is just kind of trucking along, and you know, maybe not doing as big of things as it used to, but still making some cool stuff.
Yeah, sounds really good. I'll link everything we talk about in the show notes, just for my listeners, because I think we talk about a lot of stuff that maybe is new there. I'm thinking, yeah, could be new to many of the listeners, which is great. I have a couple of more questions here. We talked about your projects, but what drives you as a person?
I think a couple of things drive me as a person. Mainly is that I want to see and experience as much of the world as I can. And I think that's been the the primary drive behind almost everything that I've done on a bike is just wanting to see and experience as much of the world and meet as many people and expand my context of what the world is. And with fixed gear racing, that was just the opportunity to travel. There were races all over the world, and all I had to do was show up on my bike and race and have a good time and, you know, kind of keep people excited and stoke people out. And then ultra endurance racing is, I think, to me, the next step of that, in which I don't have to really interact with people as much, but I'm interacting with the environment way more. You know, riding through all of these countries and actually physically experiencing the local population and the local customs and the country. So I think really just trying to see as much as I can, because I think that it's very easy to have a very narrow-minded view of the world, and of where you live and who you interact with. And I think that the world is a really amazing place. And a lot of the divides we have in the world, whether they be ideological or sociological, come from people not having a really big experience, not having a lot of experiences, or having a very small context, kind of, you know, looking at the world through a very narrow viewpoint. So I think that I want to see the world through the biggest viewpoint I can, so that I can help other people see it through a slightly larger viewpoint than they have, in the hopes that if people can see the world through a little bigger lens, they can understand where other people are coming from and hopefully accept other people a little more. So that kind of the second thing is, I want to help people improve themselves and elevate themselves and also accept other people and just kind of live a happier life. You know, TCB, the company, the courier company that I ran, was a lot about providing opportunities for people to kind of grow and help people, you know, kind of move on to the next step in their life or expand their life context. The software company that we run from that is the same thing. We want to help people gain ownership of companies. We want to help people run their own business, take control of their own life, provide opportunities for other people by providing good jobs for them. And even the ultra endurance racing and the bike packing and all of the things, is I want to encourage people to get out of their comfort zone and get outside in nature and be self-sufficient and, you know, go someplace that you've never been and meet new people and experience new things and, you know, be mildly terrified of new things, but, you know, be scared of something new, but, you know, try it, plan ahead and, you know, be responsible about exploring and adventuring. But really, I want to encourage people to get out and do things and see more of the world and expand their context so that they can be more accepting of other people around them. And then hopefully that, you know, will pass on to other people and we can all treat each other just a little bit better.
Yeah, I think we have the same values. At least these are the reasons why I started doing this podcast as well. It's my way of showing people what there is outside. Yeah. And what there is to maybe, and how empowering it is to go on these adventures. And yeah, I want to talk about one adventure you recently did. You rode near the Mexican border, I believe, and there were many pictures of trash trains. And yeah, I would love you to tell us a little bit more about that project.
Yeah, that was a really amazing tour for a number of different reasons. But to give some context, we were riding in Southern California, right next to the Mexican-American border, through some of which is called the Anza Borrego National Park. But it's essentially a large national park, a desert park. And my really good friend, Alvin Esquejeda from Los Angeles, planned the route and kind of organized the trip. And the route was all his. And the impetus of it, or the goal, was to go ride something called the Goat Canyon Trestle, which is this very, very narrow canyon that has an abandoned railroad on it that runs from essentially the border of California and Mexico, right, this town called Yacumba Hot Springs, into Anza Borrego State Park, which is kind of the high desert. And the thing that makes that interesting is that when it was built, it was called the Impossible Railroad. And it was a railroad that was built in the 1800s. And they said it was impossible because the canyon was, you know, so rugged, tons of rocks, very steep sides. And when they built it, it had, I want to say, 20-something tunnels they had to blow out, and then they built 18 or 19 trestles, wooden train bridges, for an 18-mile, so that's roughly about 30K of railroad. It, kind of an enormous amount of work for not a lot of distance covered. And the railroad didn't really last that long, because it wasn't really feasible. And so there's a ton of abandoned trains, as you saw, like covered in graffiti all up and down this tunnel, but you can ride right along the old railroad. And so you ride through all these crazy tunnels. Some of them are very short and some of them are very long. And you ride across these old rickety wooden train bridges. And some of them are like, you know, pretty small. And one of them is the largest wooden train bridge in America. And it's huge and it's terrifying. You ride across it and it's, you know, wooden, it's old. So it's making all these crazy noises and rattling in the wind. And so we wanted to go to that point. And so we started right above Tijuana, which is kind of the main city to cross over from Mexico to America in California. And we rode 2 days to the east to get to the Goat Canyon Trestle. And then we rode the Goat Canyon Trestle, which was amazing. And then we rode back, but this was in the wintertime, which luckily in California usually doesn't mean that much. In Southern California, the winter is, you know, not very cold. Maybe it rains every once in a while, but it's California. So we didn't really pack for the winter, and it poured down rain the entire time, except for when we rode the Goat Canyon Trestle, which was amazing. The only time of the entire 5-day trip that it was nice was when we were riding that one part and the sun came out and it was warm and it was perfect. So we rode out, it was raining, we got to ride the trestle, which was amazing. And then on the way back, it started snowing and we did not have really any snow gear. We had, you know, light jackets and, you know, I didn't have my Gore jackets that I would have loved to have had. I had, you know, sweatshirts and nobody brought good gloves. And so we were riding into a snowstorm and we basically got frozen. And, you know, this is kind of that thing with ultra endurance racing is, or even bike touring, is you kind of learn to embrace the hardships. And we were all like, we got this. We're tough. We can do this. We're, you know, we're loving this crazy moment and it's snowing and we're riding into a snowstorm. And we stopped at noon. We've been riding for like 5 hours that day. And we stopped at noon and there was already a couple inches of snow on the ground. And we were like, man, maybe we shouldn't do this. Like, maybe we should call it. Even though it's only noon, you know, super early to call a day. Had been camping. We just had, you know, tents and tarps and like bivy sacks. And we were like, camping out here is going to be horrible. And so we actually found the only hotel within 60 miles, I think. And luckily it was super close to where we were. And we rode there and we got a hotel and we felt really bad about it. You know, we were like, oh, we shouldn't have done that. Like, we should have kept camping. We should have been tough about it. And then it snowed like 6 inches and they shut down the highway and it turned into like a full-fledged blizzard on the Mexican-American border, which, you know, hadn't happened in years. All the locals were like, this is insane. And we woke up the next morning to like a winter wonderland covered in snow. And we feel like we made the right call in not freezing outside trying to camp and be tough.
Yeah, it sounds like.
Yeah, which is important. I think that's a thing that I would love to, you know, let people know is when you're in these situations, when you're out having these adventures, there is a fine line between being tough and experiencing, you know, the elements and enjoying the experience of this and also putting yourself in danger. And it's important to know when to kind of call it and throw in the towel and be like, okay, I'm done being tough. I don't need to get frostbite. I don't need to get sick by spending all night in my bivy freezing cold. I'm going to get a hotel. We're going to order pizza. You know, one of us walked, the one person who drew the short straw walked the mile and a half into town and bought a bunch of beer and snacks. And we had like a great time in the hotel room eating pizza and drinking beer and watching bad television. It smelled horrible, you know, four guys and all of their bike camping gear. We'd been on the road for 3 days, you know, in one hotel room. But then, you know, we woke up the next morning and the sun was shining and it was crazy. You know, we rode through snow we had to get over a mountain pass. So we rode through snow for a couple hours, and then descended down and the snow had melted. But that trip was really cool because, we got to, you know, set a goal to go see the Goat Canyon Trestle, navigate to the goal, accomplish the goal, ride the Goat Canyon Trestle. And then also got confronted with a situation that was really hard, that was against our plans. And we were flexible enough to, I think, make the right call to get the hotel before we got in any real danger. And then still flexible enough to finish the trip and enjoy it and not see that as like a failure. Because I think some people would see that as a failure. You know, you set out to do this self-supported bikepacking trip. You didn't self-support. You checked into a hotel. You ordered food. But in reality, we were safe. We had a great experience and we had a great time. You know, it was a bonding experience for the four of us. We, you know, had a wonderful night together. And we left feeling good about it. And I think that's an important thing when doing these types of adventures is to be flexible and be okay if things change and like look on the bright side and kind of take the experience as it comes. And we left, all of us left feeling really fulfilled and feeling like we accomplished something. And we finished the ride. We finished it a day later than we thought we would. And it wasn't fully self-supported, but we still finished it and we had a great adventure and none of us got frostbite or pneumonia. So I think it was a win all in all.
It sounds like a win to me. So I have two questions now. Did you carry a book with you?
I didn't, which I should have because I love reading. I read so much and I actually, when I go on like long bike, solo bikepacking trips, I always bring a paper book with me. But on this particular trip, it was a bit more of a party trip. So instead of bringing a book, I brought a little flask of whiskey instead. So I had to make that compromise.
I found this when I did some research for the podcast. I was like, is he really carrying books on bikepacking trips? I mean, I love books. And you own quite a few books and you read like 3 books a week, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I do read a lot and I do bring a lot of books on bikepacking tours, especially solo bikepacking tours. But you know what I started to do is I started to bring a Kindle, which is, I feel like, kind of cheating a little bit, but it's way easier to pack a Kindle than to pack an actual book on a bikepacking tour. So I've done that a little bit.
Yeah, it is. Especially like I sometimes go on holiday and then you're away for 1 or 2 weeks. I mean, you can't carry 4 or 5 books and then you have kids who want to read as well. So my kids all have e-readers and can download books. And yeah, because otherwise you have to like drive there just to carry all the books you want to read on your holiday.
Yeah, I totally. And especially if you're flying in Europe. And I love EasyJet and Ryanair, but if you're carrying 4 or 5 books, your bag will not fit in the overhead bin and they will definitely charge you for the extra couple kilos of weight because they love to do that. So the e-readers and the Kindles are a savior.
Definitely. And you talked about being positive and I noticed that there's a lot of PMA also in your drawings. And yeah, can you explain to us your view on PMA, positive mental attitude in life?
Yeah, PMA all day. I love it. It's from it actually isn't from a Bad Brains song, but I heard of it from a Bad Brains song. And Bad Brains is a punk rock band from Washington, D.C. in the 90s. Very influential in American punk rock music. And they have a song about, I got that PMA. I got that positive mental attitude. And for me, that's kind of, it really resounded when I heard it when I was young. And it's something that I've always stuck with. And it's something that I really try and share with people. But something that I really want to let everyone know is that positive mental attitude does not mean that you're positive all the time, because that's not realistic. That's not life. No one is positive all the time. Life is not positive all the time. Life has ups and downs, and there's some parts of life that are not positive. But PMA to me means that you believe that things will get better, that you have a positive mental attitude and you know that even if something's bad right now, that it will get better and that the situation will change. And you kind of use that to help you through the hard times or the bad times. And I think that that's important because, you know, everyone has to experience bad things in life. And I think if you didn't, it would be super weird. And it, you know, it may be a little damaging if you never had bad experiences. But it's important to remember that things will change and to kind of have a goal or, you know, a lighthouse, if you will, during a storm to kind of keep you in the right direction and keep you moving forward to help you get out of the storm. And for me, that's just PMA. That's that positive mental attitude that, man, even if life really sucks right now and this is really hard, I believe that life will get better and I just have to keep moving forward to get through this storm and get back into the sunshine, you know?
Very important right now. During this pandemic, I believe.
Yeah, more important than ever. And I also think that PMA is, you know, being flexible and kind of looking on the bright side of life. You know, the pandemic has been really hard for everyone for a number of different reasons. And I, you know, I do try and look at it like I've spent a lot more time with my family. I've read a lot more books. I've seen a lot more of California than I ever would have seen. And I know that I'm in a very lucky position to be in California and be able to travel. And it's hard for people to look on the bright side, especially if my heart goes out to all of you in Europe who are still dealing with a lot of lockdowns and a lot of restrictions, even if they are, you know, for the best of the community and to keep everyone safe. It's still a hard thing to do. But, you know, trying to look on the bright side of things, you know, even if you're in a bad situation, there's most of the time a silver lining or something that something good that can be taken out of it. And so I think it's important to acknowledge the good parts. I don't think it's, you know, I'm not saying focus on it and only look at the good parts, but if you're having a bad situation, try to find a good thing about it, at least being like, well, there's this one good thing. And then sometimes for me, at least that helps. Even if it's, you know, like going to the dentist and getting your teeth drilled and it's a horrible experience and you're, you know, shooting you up full of shots and drilling into your teeth. I always think, well, at least I'm going to have healthy teeth after this. I'm going to have clean teeth. Wait, you know, while they're like drilling into your face, try to remember that it's, you know, there's a good part of it somewhere. So
now you just reminded me that I have to make an appointment at the dentist.
I do too. I have one. I have to reschedule one next week.
Yeah, I didn't want to go there during the hard phase of the pandemic, but now I got my first vaccination and yeah, the next one is not far away. And yeah, so I dare to do, to go to the doctors, even though I don't have to immediately. So yeah. So we're coming to the end of our interview. And in the end, I always ask two questions. And the first one is a book recommendation you have for the listeners.
Okay, I have a lot of book recommendations, but I will keep it to two. And one of, they're both book series, and they're both kind of relatively new, kind of sci-fi-ish. One is full sci-fi, the other is kind of slightly science fiction. But one that I would really recommend is a book called Brilliance, by an author named Marcus Sakay, so S-A-K-A-Y. And Brilliance is the first book of a three-book series. It's called the Brilliance Trilogy. And without giving anything away, it's set kind of in modern times, but 1% of the population is born with kind of extra gifts. They're brilliant. And we're not talking like superheroes, but more like the ability to recognize patterns or the ability to kind of program a computer faster than anyone's capable. And it really deals with how that has upset society and how society deals with this group of people that's different, which I think obviously in our day and age really resonates, especially in America right now, with how does society deal with people that are different? There's a lot of fear involved. You know, how does it happen? But it's also a very entertaining book, and it's very well written, and it's kind of action adventure-y. But it does deal with a lot of like kind of very important sociological and societal issues. So I would recommend that to pretty much anybody, even if you're not a fan of science fiction or anything kind of action adventure-y. It deals with a lot of really interesting sociological issues that we're as a world currently dealing with in a way that's very easy to read and is very relatable to, you know, kind of today. So The Brilliance Trilogy by Marcus Sakay. And then I'm actually in the middle of The Expanse series, and I don't even remember who wrote it. It's a big science fiction series. It's like 8 books. Me and my partner are reading it. We're both on the 4th book right now. I think there's a Netflix series or a movie or a TV series about the book. Once again, deals with very science fiction-y, but deals with, you know, the Earth and then the people that live in the asteroid belt, the Earth and the Belters. There's this very, very big social divide between humans. I love books that deal with issues that, you know, we're presented with every day. So it's dealing with a lot of like sociological issues, kind of us versus them, but it's set in space and it's, you know, action, adventure, sci-fi stuff. So those are two books or two book series that I've been really into. And if you have read the Expanse series, don't tell me how it ends because I'm only on book 4. I'm super into it.
Really, really good. I'm tempted. I think I will buy them. You already, how do you say, you hooked me. Do you say it like this?
Would you say that I influenced you to buy them?
Maybe, yes. Maybe I have to say you influenced me. Yeah.
Well, good. There you go.
And yeah, it's not a, like when someone first called me an influencer, it wasn't even bad. It was a guy who said he always looks at my Instagram before he buys new things and just has a look, because I tend to have pieces of equipment that he otherwise doesn't know about, and he finds out things like through my Instagram. So influencing is not a bad thing. I mean, yeah, if it's good things.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing either. I know that it has kind of a stigma in society right now, and I think it's funny. I don't think it's bad either. I enjoy doing it. I love sharing my experiences with people, but I also think it's funny. Gotta laugh at yourself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, my other question is, do you have a person that inspires you? And if so, who is it?
I do have a person that inspires me. I have a lot of people that inspire me, actually. But one of the people that really inspires me right now, and this is going to sound kind of cheesy, but it's my partner, Jenny Bone. We've been together for about 7 years. She rode track bikes before me. That's an important thing she will want me to mention. She raced alley cats and rode track bikes before I even knew what a track bike was. So she's cool. We all know that. But she is a single mom, and she worked as a flight attendant. She still works as a flight attendant. And she, a couple years back, decided that she wanted to get her commercial pilot's license, and she wanted to basically go from the back of the bus to the front of the bus. And that's tough. It's expensive, but also, you know, it's a super white male dominated industry. It's the old white dudes club. And I know a lot of pilots and I love them, and most of them are really amazing people, but it's tough as a brown woman of color, you know, to break into this. And she was like, I'm going to do this. I want to do this. You know, and we're not rich. We, you know, we both work and money's tight as it is with everybody, but she is in the process of self-financing and becoming a commercial pilot. And she got her private pilot's license, and, you know, that was a huge struggle for her. And watching her do that while raising her son, and then also dealing with me and my life and the crazy things that I bring into the relationship and my travel and just me, watching her do all of that and still maintain the course through COVID, you know, and I think that's really inspiring to see someone set a goal. And even if it's going to take, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 years to achieve that goal, not stop working towards something. And I think that's applicable to everybody. You know, she set a goal of 3 years, which is obviously now pushed back a ton with COVID and everything that's happening, but she hasn't stopped working towards that goal. She's, you know, taken a step back. She's reassessed. But I think that that's, you know, that's really inspiring to me. And I obviously know more about it because I, you know, she's my partner and I know about her life and everything that's going on. We live together. But I think that anybody that sets goals for themselves, doesn't reach them in the time frame that they want to, or doesn't reach them how they want to, but still continues towards that goal and is flexible and keeps moving forward, I think that's inspiring. I think that it's something that is big in ultra endurance cycling. It's called constant forward motion. And, you know, no matter how bad things look, and no matter how crushed you are, or you're tired, or you're not met your goal, your flat tires, just keep moving forward. And that's kind of all that matters, because eventually you'll get there. And that's all. It's an easy thing to say. It's a hard thing to do. And so I'm inspired by people that keep moving forward.
So cool. I was hoping and maybe a little bit expecting that you would, that she would be your inspirational person, because when, like, I follow you on Instagram, of course, and every time you post about her, you can just feel the power. And yeah, it's like, I'm not surprised that you just told us all these details about her development. And she has a very, very strong, how do you say, like, you can see it from the outside, even through pictures. And yeah, so cool. And I saw that she flew you to some place just the other day.
She flew me to a gravel race. It was amazing. I have never been flown to a bike race before. That was seriously the coolest thing ever. And it was, I was terrified. It was super windy that day. And I, like, I'm going to be honest, I almost puked landing. Not because she landed, not because of anything she did, just because when you're in a tiny plane like that and it's really windy, it is like a roller coaster. And she was super cool. And she was like, oh, this is, she's like, this is really gnarly, but I got this. And I was like, hey, baby, you got this. Like, don't throw up, whatever you do. Like, oh God. And she landed fine. And it was great. But yeah, my, our ultimate goal is to go plane camping. There's a ton of hot springs in California that you can fly to, essentially, like small dirt strips. And so our goal as a couple is to fly to hot springs and go, you know, like, camp at a hot spring, or even just fly to a hot spring in the mountains for a soak and then fly home. But I also really want her to be able to drop me off for bike tours, fly me someplace to some crazy remote airport, drop me and my bike off and a friend in a bike off, and then, you know, leave us there, and then we'll ride home from wherever she dropped us off at. So this is it. This is baby steps. I mean, people think that you get somewhere like these amazing things, like, oh, you're gonna, you know, fly to get dropped off to a bike tour. That's crazy. It doesn't happen overnight. She spent years doing this. This is the first time it was an hour flight to a local gravel race, but anything is possible if you keep moving forward and you take small steps. And I'm a perfect example of that. I didn't get to where I'm at doing these great things with my life overnight. I've spent the last 16 years making mistakes and, you know, stumbling along and trying to figure out what works. It's like, you just got to keep moving forward and keep your eye on kind of the horizon on some goal, and you'll get there eventually.
Yeah, I agree. My life is kind of, it's a continuous move forward, but not always in the, like, really right direction, but it's a move forward.
I mean, like, never in the direction you think it's going to go to. Like, everyone picks a direction, and I don't know anybody that's ended up in the direction that they picked. You know, you just kind of keep moving forward and hope that it works out for the best.
Yeah. So I believe I've asked you all my questions, but is there anything you want the people to know? Something that maybe I have not asked and you want to tell everyone?
No, I mean, I feel like your questions were really good. I mean, like you said, we just had a really good conversation. But I mean, I guess the thing I want everyone to know is keep the PMA, you know, keep the positive mental attitude, even if life is tough. Believe it's going to get better and keep moving forward, constant forward motion. Just keep going and you'll get there. And it may not be where you want to, it may not be where you thought you were going to get, but it'll be somewhere. So there's always that.
Perfect ending to this interview. Thanks a lot, Chess. I really appreciate you took the time, and I really liked this conversation with you. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, tell your friends or leave me a nice 5-star comment on Apple Podcasts. Thanks also to the two brands that supported this episode, Velocio and Ortlieb. Check out Velocio's Unity jersey, and remember, you have to order until the 31st of May, which is in 2 or 3 days, depending when you hear this podcast. Maybe worth mentioning, Ortlieb has just started a Komoot profile and is collecting escape routes. So check out their routes for some cool, nice new tracks. For example, in Berlin, scouted by Road Bike Party and 8000 Watt, and myself. But I believe mine is not online yet, so you have to stay tuned for that. Just follow them on Komoot. I'll link everything in the episode description. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and see you in 2 weeks.